And welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We're broadcasting from the campus of the University of California, Irvine, and on the internet at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and the business of writing. Today my guest is Nina Bernstein, a reporter for the New York Times since 1995. She's written on a wide range of social welfare and legal issues, both as a national correspondent and as a metropolitan reporter, most recently covering poverty, policy, and child welfare in New York City. Her book, The Lost Children of Wilder, The Epic Struggle to Change Foster Care, published in hardback by Pantheon in 2001 and was a vintage paperback in 2002, won the 2002 Penn Literary Award for First Nonfiction and the 2002 New York Public Library Helen Bernstein Award for Excellence in Journalism, as well as being chosen as one of five finalists for both the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award last year. In their citation, the judges of the Penn Literary Awards wrote, "The saga of a drawn-out lawsuit isn't the likeliest subject of a page-turner. Still, in The Lost Children of Wilder, The Epic Struggle to Change Foster Care, Nina Bernstein has written a dream of a book about a nightmare of such a case, which crept through the New York judicial system between early 1970s and late 1990s. Authoritatively reported, brilliantly paced, unflinchingly open to the motives and emotions of all parties concerned, Bernstein's work unassailably shows how the futures of poor black children in this city are routinely suffocated by the implacably adversarial setup of the municipal bureaucracy and legal process. Her big picture indicts a New York few New Yorkers wish to acknowledge, and her stories of two lost children, Shirley Wilder, whose name was on the suit as plaintiff, and her son Lamont, endow that indictment with a tragic and shaming radiance, a masterpiece." Before joining the New York Times, Ms. Bernstein was a reporter for New York Newsday, the Milwaukee, Wisconsin Journal, in the Des Moines, Iowa Register and Tribune. She served as a foreign correspondent for Newsday in 1990 to 91, covering German reunification and the end of the Cold War from Berlin, and reported from Bosnia during the summer of 1992. This fall, she will be a journalism fellow at the American Academy in Berlin, where her project is social welfare in a time of globalization. Hi, Nina.
Hi.
Great to have you.
It's great to be here.
Oh, this book, The Lost Children of Wilder, The Epic Struggle to Change Foster Care. Tell our listeners how it came about.
Well, I was a reporter for Newsday at the time, and I was researching a newspaper article on problems in foster care, and I went to the stack of legal documents in an old case that I'd heard about and began going through it to try to understand really the background of the mess that foster care was in New York early in 1990. And I discovered that this case that I heard about, lawyers talked about it as though it were Jarndyce and Jarndyce, the case in Bleak House that mm-hmm. went on so long people forgot what it meant. Mm. And I discovered there was this real child, Shirley Wilder, and that at 13... when the suit was filed, she was this abused runaway. And a year after the suit was filed, she had given birth to a son and had to leave him behind in the same foster care system that the lawsuit had been struggling to change all along. It was still in court, you know, at that point. It had been filed in 1973, and it was still in court. And at first, I just wanted to know what had happened to that baby. It was really the mystery of this lost baby that pulled me into the case.
So it was a story, I mean, it really started from your interest in one child.
Yes, that's right. I mean, of course, it was one of those moments as a reporter when a kind of buzzer goes off in your mind and you realize the story of this girl, Shirley, and this baby could be a narrative frame that would let me dig deeper in and make compelling this system that is such seems like such a failure, and the reasons why. I mean, that was really the part of the question for me. It was this combination. It was the big picture. Why is it like this? Why is it so hard to fix? Because I'd been covering these issues on and off for years as a reporter, and not just in New York. So there was that motivation of wanting to dig deeper into the reasons, and the other was just this burning curiosity to know what had happened to this child, and the recognition that there was a human narrative there that might give me a real framework for compelling readers to care.
Interesting. Now, this book took 7 years.
Yeah, it was 7 years or eight. I mean, I sometimes have trouble figuring out how long it really took, because what happened was that I went at that point in 1990, I still remember running to the office from the stack of documents to Marsha Robinson Lowry, the lawyer who had, stubborn lawyer who had started the lawsuit back in 73, this class action named for Shirley Wilder, and was still litigating it all those years later. And asked her if she knew where Shirley was and what had happened to Lamont, her son. And she told me that Shirley, she didn't know, Shirley had disappeared, but every so often Shirley resurfaced and would phone her, and she promised that when that happened, she would be in touch with me. And for 3 years, I really went to different places, you know, as you mentioned in your introduction, Berlin and Bosnia and, of course, other stories in New York. But every so often, every time I would come back or resurface from a project, I would call and say, "Have you heard from Shirley?" Because I just couldn't, it haunted me. I mean, the thought of this baby who was probably growing up behind the scenes while the lawsuit was very controversial. It had been very controversial, and it was still being battled in court and at City Hall, because it had essentially challenged the whole way that New York City treated the children who came into foster care, particularly Black and Hispanic children, children of color, who were not Catholic, who were not Jewish, and who were not white, in a system that had essentially been set up to by Catholic and Jewish nonprofit agencies with public money.
Interesting. As a reporter, more used to the short form, mm-hmm. What was it about the idea that made you feel or know that there was enough there that you would stay with it, that you would just take it the distance until it was done, until the project was done?
Well, I did a two-part series for New York Newsday first about in 93 about the Wilder case. Because I found Lamont after Shirley asked me, "Find your son," and I did find him aging out of the foster care system. And the story that he told me and that I pieced together, in part, really I had to, it was a detective enterprise to find where he had been, because it involved, he'd been sent to, at one point, to Minnesota to be adopted by a white family who changed their minds within a year. I mean, he had been through just about everything that it's possible for that system to deal a child. And I found at the time that when I finished this two-part series, unlike every other time that I'd finished a major project as a journalist, I knew there were so many more layers to the story than I had been able to tell, that it probe in a newspaper story. And I also knew that it was enormously rich with human drama. It was not just on the Shirley and Lamont. Certainly, they're really the core, the heart and soul of the book. But Marsha Lowry, the lawyer who had stuck with it there really are a lot of heroes in the book, even though terrible things happen. There were so many people who were well motivated, and I wanted to understand. I just knew that there were. This was a combination of rich human drama and important social problem, and finally history. The history of this system was something that was the deep history of these arrangements that. That seem to perpetuate themselves. I wanted to be able to tell, and I knew that I could never do that in a newspaper story. I knew that it would take a book that what I wanted to do was to write a book that would read like a novel.
Mm-hmm. Which it does.
Well, thank
Which
you.
Which it does, and all the awards you've received for it certainly point to that as well. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. My guest is Nina Bernstein, author of The Lost Children of Wilder, The Epic Struggle to Change Foster Care, in paperback published by Vintage this year. Oh, in the book, you have reconstructed so many of the situations that Lamont, Marcia Lowry, Shirley, Wilder, so many people went through. How much research must you do for a project of this sort? And how do you know when you're done, or are you ever done doing the research?
Well, I think of my study right now, which still has all these files and piles. It's amazing in a way how much research it can take. I mean, and just to give you an idea of what was involved, when I one of the places that I want. Well, I should explain that Shirley Wilder, when she entered the system at really 11 as a runaway, her stepmother beat her. Her father was an alcoholic who tried to molest her. She had her mother had died when she was 4, and her grandmother, who took over her care, died when she was 11, and Shirley, everybody agreed that Shirley needed a foster home, but she entered the system where black Protestant children have to wait for the leftovers. And when agency after agency, these private faith-based agencies, as we would call them today, turned her down, she spent a year in detention. And finally, the judge, this really very fine judge, Justine Wise Pollier, who had spent her whole career trying to reform the system, felt that she could do no better than to send her to the Hudson School, training school for girls, this harsh reformatory in upstate New York. So, of course, I wanted to go up and visit this reformatory, which by then and still now is a medium security men's prison. The superintendent, in talking to me on the phone and agreeing to let me come up and look, said, "I suppose you want to see the old graveyard." Oh, yes, I mean, of course. And by the time I went up, I had learned that this graveyard, there were stories that the house mothers told the girls to frighten them, that some said that bad girls were buried there, some said that babies were buried there. And when I walked into this cemetery, I saw there were these gravestones with just girls' names, very very old gravestones, no epitaphs, you know, no dates, and it was at the edge of a ravine with wild lily of the valley growing over it. It was, I just got chills, and I had to know, I had to learn who were these, who was buried there, who were these women or these girls or these babies. And it was doubly important because this, I felt that they were some of these lost children in the title, of course, Shirley and Lamont, but it's also a lot of other lost children, and these were among them. So I spent time with, microfiche death records. I was able to match the names on the gravestones with deaths. These were mainly women and some babies, because there were some babies who had died when they were born, and there were women who had died in childbirth, girls, really. It was at a point where it had been called the Women's House of Refuge, House of Refuge for Women, and it was, of course, really also a prison, a very harsh place. And I was able to match names and death dates, but I really didn't know that much. And I later, in interviewing people who had been there at the time that Shirley was there, that was another piece of it, to try to get a real picture of what it was like and what Shirley would have experienced there. And I learned from a psychologist who had been at the institution that there were ledgers. There were old ledgers that had been in the basement. She had read them. She'd read old ledgers. She'd read old files. In fact, just as an aside, it was through her that I learned that Ella Fitzgerald had spent a year in this training school. She had never spoken about it. Mm. It was at a time, incidentally, when she was not allowed to sing in the girls' choir because it was all white.
Mm.
It was one of those little things that you discover along the way, mm. and you say, how can I put this in my book? And then your editor says, it does not belong in, uh-huh. in this book. It's something else. Anyway, so I had all these pieces, but I couldn't find those ledgers. I wanted to find then the ledgers, and it took me tracking back, and I went to the state archives, and they said, no, it doesn't exist. And ultimately, just by not giving up, I was able to discover that the state archives had never cataloged it. It had been forgotten. These boxes had been forgotten in a back room, and they brought them out, and I found essentially the voices of these women and girls, and I found the stories of some of these very girls who were buried in the woods. And it was not, though, until 4 years later when I caught up with Shirley Wilder again in a prison visiting room, that I was able to ask her if she had ever been in this graveyard, if she knew about it, because I didn't know how all this was going to fit in my narrative, and I knew that it had to fit in the narrative. And there she told me that, oh yes, when I tried to run away from the training school, I ran into the cemetery, and I was with this other girl, and we were so scared when we saw the graves because we had been told that bad girls were buried there, and we would be caught if we ran away, and there it was.
Mm.
Actually, that's one of my favorite passages in the book, because in a matter of a page and a or two, I have essentially 4 years of research distilled.
Now, how do you do that? I mean, you have all this material, probably much more than you ever used, and
mm-hmm.
and how do you distill it?
Well, I think the most important thing for me was to try to write from a combination of the point of view of the in that case, Shirley. And yet, also, I really did adopt a kind of omniscient third person. You know, kind of I did feel as if in a way I was writing, trying to write nonfiction Dickens for our time and story, the narrative, the just wanting to know what happens next, keeping the suspense, all that was extremely important. And so you are forced then to let a lot fall by the wayside or find ways to just tuck it in. You know, tuck in the detail, find the right detail. No matter how much time you've expended getting 5 pieces of information, you have to figure out which is the one that is the most telling, that works the best in that particular paragraph.
Interesting. Oh, you're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest is Nina Bernstein, who is a New York Times staff writer and author of The Lost Children of Wilder, The Epic Struggle to Change Foster Care. Well, then speaking of, there's been a lot of references to fiction, to Dickens. Did you outline this book? Did you have to outline it or write a synopsis or do anything to make sure you stayed on track?
I have to admit that I'm more of a sort of organic writer. I mean, I'm not saying that I didn't have an idea of what chapters, at least some of them, how it would go. But truthfully, with this book, I thought that I was going to finish it much sooner than I did, and it was a book that kept expanding in both directions. It certainly felt that way, at least. That by that I mean that the lawsuit, the litigation, actually continued. It didn't. The litigation did not totally come to an end. The Wilder case was not put to rest until 1999, and I, after all, had started. I'd really started writing about it in 1993, and I was delving deeper and deeper into the history of the foster care system. So I guess I would say that what helped a lot was in the early stages, my editor, the acquiring editor at Pantheon, was Linda Healy, and she, I think, had a better grasp than I did of how challenging and how long this project would be, because she was then the wife of, now the widow of, Tony Lucas, J. Anthony Lucas, who wrote Common Ground, a book that won the Pulitzer and told the story of busing in and desegregation in Boston through three families. And that was a book that took him 10 years, and I know she wasn't telling me it was going to take 10 years, but I do remember that the original contract was I was ready to say I would deliver a manuscript in a year, and she said it has to be at least 18 months. As you realize it was a lot longer than that. But she really helped me enormously in the early stages, because I gave her chapters and she helped me find that authorial voice that I was talking about before. I think especially for journalists, there are all these journalistic tics that you don't want to let go. He said, she mused, the looking backwards. I thought at first I was going to tell the story more or less from my point of view, or at least partly as a detective story, as a piecing this together. And I soon realized that that was a big mistake, that this had to be chronological.
I like that. I like that idea a lot.
what idea?
Gives me hope. Just that that this book is as complex as it is was more organic, wasn't finely outlined or plotted,
and there were revisions and revisions. I mean, I went through. On one level, I was extremely lucky. I won an Alicia Patterson Foundation Fellowship in 1994 my project was foster care and the politics of poverty, but basically it was the book was the project. I had done this, the two-part series in Newsday, and that became the basis of, I got an agent through that, Gloria Loomis, who's just magnificent, and I got I got the Patterson, and then I wrote the book proposal with help from Gloria. And at that point, I think I thought I was going to do it, the bulk of it, in a year. Instead, I extended the leave that I had from Newsday by another 6 months, and then the day before I was due back at Newsday, the New York City edition of Newsday, which is where I worked, was shut down by the Times Mirror Company. and I suddenly had to find a job. So the book got put on hold for really quite a long time. I luckily was hired by the Times, and I was able to negotiate with them up front that I would get down the road, I would get another book leave. But that was delayed, and there was really a two-year period when the characters, the protagonists, were continuing to live their lives, and things were happening very much so, and the manuscript was getting cold, and I couldn't work on it. I mean, there were things that I did for the Times on child welfare that actually helped me a lot, and I gave another layer or some more depth to the book, I'm sure. And I think in retrospect, the arc of the narrative is one that I could never have anticipated how everything would come together in the end. So now I can say I'm glad that it took as long as it did, but at the time it just felt like I was never going to be able to do it. And when I took my leave, it took a while to get back into the manuscript, and I still remember the moment, this period when I came back to the Times. I had this unwieldy, it was too long, it wasn't completed manuscript. I thought I had derailed my career at the Times. I had been on the national desk. I was sent to the Metro desk the day I came back. I didn't, and then not that long afterwards, Linda Healy left Pantheon. So I had the prospect of my book is being orphaned. It isn't finished. It was a very, very low point. But thanks in part to my agent, and of course this is one of the great things that she'll always be on your side. You know, you'll call, and she totally believed in this book and in this project all along. And Dan Frank, the top editor at Pantheon, very eagerly took it on. And at that point, I needed more than anything else. I needed a really intelligent outsider to tell me, here you have to cut, here I want more. What I was trying to do, which was really very ambitious, was to create a braid that would be these three parts, this compelling human narrative, this story that would make people want to keep turning the pages and really identify with Shirley and Lamont. The legal case, you know, in a sense, this ongoing, the saga of what was happening to the lawsuit, and finally the deep history. And I knew that if the two second pieces of this braid were too heavy, it wouldn't work. It had to be driven by the narrative. But it's very hard to judge that when you're that close. And Dan was just wonderful. I do remember, though, reading this this report. I think it was by some other reader at Pantheon who at a point where I had done quite a bit of revision, and there was this report that said, Bernstein is writing a wonderful book. And what I noticed was, I mean, I liked the wonderful, but I also saw is writing. And I thought at that point that I had written, you know, it was done, and it wasn't done anymore. It wasn't done yet. Even when I thought it was done, it wasn't done. The revisions early in the morning before coming into the Times, you know, in my nightgown when my sons would wake up and find me, you know, at my laptop. Those were the days. It seems like it is still astonishing to me sometimes when I think back to that, and I can still look at those files, those papers. I mean, I had sort of created this nest of disorder around me, and it's still pretty disorderly. And I remember back to that, and I look now at that silver sticker on the book, you know, National Book Award finalist and the other awards, and it seems incredible.
I want to talk more with you about that, and I want to let you give you a minute to get a drink of water. Let's take a real short break. We'll be right back with more Nina Bernstein. Please don't go away. And we're back with Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine. And I'm with Nina Bernstein. She's a New York Times staff writer and author of The Lost Children of Wilder, The Epic Struggle to Change Foster Care. We're going to bring her back on. And before we do, I want to say that the opinions that you hear on the show are those of me and my author and no one else, not the University of Regents, no one but us. And I will have a ticket giveaway for you at the end of the show, so stay tuned to the very end, and I'll tell you what tickets I am giving away. Nina, mm-hmm. wanted to ask you about receiving the nomination for the National Book Award and the other awards, and how does that feel when you learn of a nomination or you learn of an award? You started saying a few words about it, but does that make sense of all the years of work?
Well, in this case, I honestly, I wanted to write a book that was reviewed, of course. I hoped to get some good reviews, and I knew that even that, it might not even be reviewed. I mean, I know that a lot of wonderful books fall into a black hole, and that you have to somehow be prepared for that. You have to be obsessed enough, passionate enough about this particular book that you want to write, that somehow even that intellectual knowledge doesn't stop you. But to actually not only get good reviews, but I still remember being in the newsroom and getting this phone call, and it was totally out of the blue for me, the phone call from Neil Baldwin of the National Book Award to let me know that the book was a finalist. I started to choke up. I mean, I thought it might be a hoax. I asked if I could call him back. I mean, it was because it's, of course, you can't, they're fantasies. You have fantasies, right? But I hadn't even indulged in that particular fantasy. And so it's wonderful. And at the same time, you know, I'm a reporter, and so I'm also still in this day-to-day world of journalism, and there's this funny split that I experience now, because I feel in my day-to-day world, it's like, oh, still that book? I mean, that was long ago, and what are you doing now? What have you done lately? and of course, there is always the question, so are you working on another book? I'm not working on another book, I will tell you right now. Not yet, and it's clearly going to take me, since I know it, another book will take me a long time, and it will involve my whole being, since that seems to be the only way I know how to work. I want to be very careful what topic I pick. But I think one of the things I'll have to steel myself for is that there is just no way that I could be that lucky again. I mean, yes, I clearly wrote a good book, but it's, you need a confluence of chances for it to be on a short list, a couple of short lists like that, and to win awards like that, because there's so many other wonderful books that, for reasons that no one can particularly make sense of, yes. aren't.
A while ago, you talked about finding your voice, that, mm-hmm. that you were a journalist, and it was the, you had the need to tap into the voice and just find that voice. And I wonder if you would talk a little bit about that, because the tone of the book, the voice, the language, it's also pristine. And I'd love to hear what you have to say about finding your voice.
Well, in a way, I must say I'm tempted at this point to read a little from the book, because
yes, let's do it.
The voice of the book is so much better than the way I talked. And in fact, if I read some of this, the passage of when Shirley was trying to escape from Hudson, I think you'll see how, in fact, how that works, okay. The difference between the voice of the book, the authorial voice, and my voice just talking to you in conversation okay. about these same things.
Let's do it. And if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing, and Nina Bernstein is about to read from The Lost Children of Wilder.
There was still snow on the ground the day Shirley Wilder and another girl followed a dirt road at the upper end of the grounds into the woods, hunting for a way out. The road soon vanished among the drifts and wet black tree trunks. Moving through the shadows of a grove of cedars, they suddenly found themselves in a clearing at the edge of a steep, wooded ravine. It was a small cemetery. The old gravestones had been so tilted by spring frosts and winter thaws that they looked almost scattered. There were no dates on the weathered markers and no epitaphs, only girls' names fading from bare limestone. Lizzie French, Nellie McGovern, Anna Schabesberger, Mary O'Brien, Helen Peer. Shirley remembered the stories she had heard from a house mother and some of the girls. They said a secret graveyard lay hidden in the woods on the Hudson grounds. Years ago, dead babies born to inmates were buried there, and bad girls, too. Girls caught trying to escape who later died inside the institution. Other bodies were sent home to their folks for burial, but even after death, runaways were punished. This was their solitary confinement, a cold, dark grave lost in the woods forever. Shirley began to tremble, and the other girl cried out in fright. They turned and ran away as fast as they could. At the other end of the Hudson grounds, they climbed over the fence together and slid down a slope into a stubble of cattails and frozen loosestrife. For hours, they stumbled through the big swamp that bordered the institution, looking for a road out. Pockets of ice cracked underfoot and gave way to marshy ground. They fell and scrambled upright again, foul-smelling muck soaking their shoes and clothes. Running, trudging, running again, they couldn't escape the icy wind that whipped in off the river. They clutched at stiff weeds with raw fingers to keep from slipping. Shirley's feet swelled, and her ears went numb with cold. They were lost, lost in the vast wetland that had once been the South Bay. Whaling ships were moored here in another century. The first ones carried the town's founders, prosperous whalers from Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, who came seeking a safer harbor in the revolutionary world of 1783. In the 1840s, when impoverished tenant farmers rebelled against their vassalage under Hudson Valley landowners, troop ships sailed here too, bringing soldiers to crush the revolt. Then the railroad arrived. The New York to Albany line was laid on causeways right across the mouth of the South Bay, cutting it off from the river in 1851. An iron factory spewed its wastes into the stranded bay. The bay became a putrid swamp, and on a promontory above this swamp, the House of Refuge for Women was built. The word refuge was misleading. From the moment the stone and wrought iron gates of the institution first swung open on May 7, 1887, solitary confinement was the preferred mode of treatment. Though I have been very much impeded by the newness of the institution and my desire to enforce a rigorous discipline, Sarah V. Kuhn, the first superintendent, reported in November 1888, still, so far as it has been possible in our overcrowded prison, I have tried to isolate each girl upon her arrival from the older inmates. Besides solitary confinement, confinement in dark cells with disciplinary diet and handcuffs is in vogue. Shirley, scrambling through the marsh in the slanting winter light of 1973, was one in a long line of girls who had tried to escape this form of education. Most were quickly apprehended. A few got away. $25 reward, announced the Hudson Gazette on November 14, 1895. Saturday last, a reward of $25 was offered for the return of Catherine Burns, who escaped from the House of Refuge for Women in the city on the night of October 23rd. Catherine Burns was never found. Perhaps she melted into one of the lost colonies of runaways that people the legends of the Hudson River Valley. But surely, a city child lost in a tangle of scrub oak and swamp hickory, the wilderness held no promise of refuge. At last, through thickening woods and gathering dusk, she saw the lights of a house and ran to it.
Thank you. That was...
But you know, I realize that I forgot to tell you and your listeners that before Shirley resolved to escape, she had the experience that so many girls, I think, before did, of being trapped by an older gang of girls and who tried to rape her with a broomstick. And when she fought back, the staff treated her by placing her in solitary confinement. So the theme of solitary confinement was one that had been perpetuated in this institution. And for me, the question was, how was I going to find the voice that would evoke this, not in a journalistic way that, you know, and records from 1883 show, you know what,
yes,
I mean? The way,
yeah,
the way you would do it if you were writing a newspaper story. Or Shirley told of, you know, sitting in her apartment in 1993, Shirley recalled. I mean, that's, of course, the way you would write a newspaper story. And the question was, how could I be absolutely accurate and keep the standards of the journalistic standards that essentially were drummed into me, not just in all my newspaper jobs, but at my father's knee, actually. I'm a second-generation journalist. And yet, write it the way, with so that the voice that the reader heard was one that they had confidence in and wanted to follow, and in a way that narrative nonfiction can do, and really no other form can.
Yeah. We have a few minutes left. You're listening to Writers on Writing. Nina Bernstein, author of The Lost Children of Wilder, The Epic Struggle to Change Foster Care, is with us for a few more minutes. In terms of voice, now, did that take a lot of revision, a lot of crafting, a lot of chipping away at what was there, or did you find it and did you stay with it then?
I think there was a kind of breakthrough. I think in this early stage where Linda Healy would give me back a chapter and have passages underlined or crossed out and notes in the margin, I started to realize what was wrong, and there was some point of breakthrough where once you have it, I think you can keep it. The problem was, there was a problem regaining it when the manuscript got cold and finding it again, but it is a little like when you're on a bicycle and you pick up speed and you're, there really was a wonderful freeing feeling to it. It's really hard to describe, but I think that I wish it on every writer.
Well, do you find that it changes from piece to piece, from book to article to whatever you're working on, that you have to find the voice of that work, and that it's not simply your voice as a writer?
Oh, you're so right. Oh, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. This was the voice for this book. I completely agree that it would not be, you have to find a different, you do have to find a different tone. And sometimes, I think the revision is, the revision is crucial, of course, and I don't mean to suggest that once I found some magic, I never had to look back. It wasn't that way at all, but particularly because I think that the voice was a little bit different, and there were chapters that are from Marsha Robinson Lowry's point of view, for example, and I wanted the tone to reflect her words more. And in writing a different kind of, obviously in writing a newspaper article, you're going to try to match the tone to some extent to the material. And, well, I mean, I guess that's maybe that's self-evident, but it's to be done over and over again. There's no question.
Interesting. We have a couple of minutes left, literally 2 minutes, and I wonder if you have any words of wisdom or advice that you would pass on to the writers listening.
Don't give up. I really think that for me the lesson of this book was that in my darkest hour, by sticking it out, I was able to do something that it's twofold. It isn't just the awards. I would say the most important thing to me is I feel that I wrote a book that someone could find 20 years from now in a library. Maybe nobody's checked it out in a decade, but they could find it and read it and still find it compelling. That's what I wanted to do. And I think that if writers think about doing that rather than will it be on a bestseller list or will it get great reviews, if you can just get it between two covers and have it somewhere where someone could find it and you'd be speaking to them. You know, I think that vision, that for me that vision worked, and I think that that, you know, don't give it up, keep trying for that.
Yes, Nina, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
It's been a great pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks. Bye bye.
Bye bye. That was Nina Bernstein. She is author of The Lost Children of Wilder, The Epic Struggle to Change Foster Care, published in softback by Vintage earlier this year. And she was speaking to us from the New York Times in New York City. Oh boy, the end of another show. So fast it goes. I want to end with a quote by the poet Marianne Moore, who said, "Originality is a byproduct of sincerity." This is 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine, California. The tickets I have to give away are tickets for Dan Fogelberg, 2 pair to be given away. He'll be at the Grove of Anaheim Tuesday, July 2nd at 7 p.m. All ages are welcome. If you are the first to email me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net, tickets will go to you. Be sure to leave your full name and phone number should you email me for these tickets, and do it now. Thanks so much for listening, and stay tuned for Melissa, and I'll be with you soon.